Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. COVID-19 numbers are skyrocketing in Wyoming, and hospitals are facing an unprecedented demand for their services as cases, hospitalizations, and the need for care continue to skyrocket.
There may be available beds, but we're struggling to have enough staff to take care of the patients if we do admit them.
As COVID-19 surges, Campbell County is feeling some of the effects of a high spike in cases.
We are struggling to stay staffed. So this is a little different than March.
And we'll take a look at why public health officials are asking people to follow social distance guidelines, whether they have COVID-19 or if they may have been exposed to it.
An active case may give birth to 3 or 4 additional cases.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Positive COVID-19 cases are skyrocketing in communities across Wyoming. As of Thursday, there were more than 11,000 active cases, with over 1,300 in Campbell County alone. But addressing the problem has been a challenge. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explains.
Since late September, the number of overall cases of COVID-19 has risen by more than 400%. At a recent press conference, Governor Mark Gordon expressed his anger over the dilemma the state finds itself in.
Our state is under the most strain that it has seen since it began, and it's not letting up, it's going straight up. We've had the most deaths of any period in the last 30 days, and those are now coming in groups of tens. Most hospitalizations, daily records this week, capacity issues.
Gillette Mayor Louise Carter King says back in the spring, the community wasn't seeing a high number of cases, so it opened back up. But things have changed.
This time it's a little different because there's been some restaurants had to close because of staffing. And I know just with the city, just our organization, we are struggling to stay staffed. So this is a little different than March.
According to a press release, from October 5th to November 5th, Campbell County saw close to a 900% increase in active cases, averaging 33 new confirmed cases per day. And the virus isn't sparing anyone's staffing, not even health officials. According to the Gillette News Record, about half of Campbell County's public health staff are out with COVID-19. It led to them having to put a pause on its drive-up flu clinic and its COVID-19 testing. And the same goes for the hospital. Colleen Heater is the CEO of Campbell County Health.
I think one of the biggest significant hindrances for us is we also are seeing, you know, anywhere from 80 to 120 staff out on quarantine or illness routinely.
Hospital officials say that's a big issue as the number of COVID-related hospitalizations has been steadily rising over the past few weeks. Campbell County Health's chief nursing officer, Misty Robertson, says all of these factors could eventually overwhelm the hospital.
We're dealing with both increased volume of patients and some of our staff not being available because they're ill or quarantined. Kind of a double hit to the organization when, like most hospitals, we have staff or kind of our normal activity. So when some of them are out or we've got more activity than usual, it can be a hardship.
Hospital officials say that more funding for additional staff, like traveling nurses, is helpful to fill in the gaps. And Governor Mark Gordon has announced that $10 million of federal CARES Act funding will go towards alleviating that strain across the state. As part of that effort, the governor's office announced it's sending one of two federal medical system disaster teams to Gillette because of the immediate need in the area. The team will be made up of 15 staff, doctors and nurses, and they'll stay for 2 weeks. Governor Gordon has left it up to local governments to impose preventative measures. And as of Wednesday, 12 counties and the Wind River Reservation have mandated masks in indoor public settings. However, Campbell County is not one. At a recent commissioners' meeting, the officials made a county employee mask mandate to hopefully keep more staffing issues like the one at Public Health at bay. But they've stopped short of drafting a countywide mandate for residents. Commissioner Del Shellstad was a vocal critic of the governor's health orders back in March. He says that this employee mandate is not a precursor to a countywide one.
I feel like the governor gave us a unique opportunity to try to control the things that are happening in our county locally. So this is an effort for us to try to get a handle on our numbers.
So as part of that personal responsibility piece, health officials are recommending taking a look at Thanksgiving plans. And for the long term, they ask that you wear a mask, social distance, and get a flu shot to help lessen the burden on healthcare as we head into flu season. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Since the start of the pandemic, nursing homes and long-term care facilities have been on pins and needles. With some huge outbreaks in facilities across the state leading to a number of deaths, that anxiety has now skyrocketed. Johnny Belden oversees the Legacy Living and Rehabilitation Center in Campbell County. She joins me to describe the challenges they've faced keeping their older residents safe and the impacts this is having on their staff. We begin our conversation discussing the residents themselves. I would think you really want the folks that are in there to be able to interact with family members and friends and that sort of thing. But at the same time, you're always worried about a little bit of an outbreak taking place. Was that a challenge, at least from your position?
Yes. From the very beginning, our mantra, our goal has been to avoid exposure and prevent transmission. And there were some federal, state guidelines that were very clear in what we needed to follow in terms of visiting individuals being able to come into long-term care facilities. That was very emotional for many of our residents and our families because they were not allowed to visit. During the summer and into the fall, we were able to, through CMS, CDC, and the Wyoming Department of Health guidelines, we were able to loosen those visiting restrictions a bit. But from the very beginning, we were committed to ensuring that we had resident connection with their families. We accomplished that through window visits, virtual visits, outdoor visits. And then this fall, we were able to implement our Huggy Hut, where residents and families were able to be protected by a plexiglass barrier, but were able to hug each other using appropriate personal protective equipment. We also implemented some limited indoor visiting and compassionate care visits for those individuals who were end of life or had visiting every day prior to the pandemic. That is really hard for everyone, and it's hard for our staff, it's hard for our residents, it's hard for our families. As the virus infection has increased in Campbell County, we have had to dial back that visiting, and we've gone back to the window, the virtual visits, and compassionate visits, just because we have to avoid exposure and prevent transmission.
How have the numbers been up your way? Because I think you're doing a little bit better in some other places, aren't you?
We have been fortunate. I do believe that all long-term care administrators and staff are doing the very best they can to prevent outbreaks in their facilities. It is our staff who are the ones who are diligent to wear their masks, wear their eye protection, and do everything we can to prevent the transmission in our facilities. We have had a total, since the beginning of the pandemic, 10 residents who have been positive. Our mandatory testing that we are doing for our staff and our residents has identified some of our residents and staff that are asymptomatic. So we've been able to mitigate any transmission that might occur. We have been fortunate, but we also know this virus is very contagious and it requires constant diligence and vigilance to prevent the outbreaks.
I want to ask you about staff a little bit. I think we all understand that there has got to be tremendous pressure and stress on all of you, but especially the folks that are dealing with some of the residents on a frontline basis. Could you talk a little bit about what they're going through and maybe how you try and help them along?
They are wonderful. They care so much for the residents that they are doing the testing without complaint. They are showing up and being present, even having to wear masks and eye protection. They care so much about the residents. In addition to that, it is very hard for them because they care so much and they are the ones cleaning their rooms, bringing them their food, caring for their most personal needs. They hear the sorrow and the grieving that the residents are having. And, you know, that breaks their hearts. So, but they are so creative and innovative to find ways to help keep them connected with their families, to help them find things that bring them joy. What our organization is doing for our staff is multi-pronged. We have resources for mental health. We have resources that our staff can reach out to help with how do you cope with having to come to work but then having to go home and still have to take care of families or having sick family members as well. So we have mental health resources. We have free food. Free food is always good. We have community members that have donated items to help support our staff, to encourage our staff. Our legacy advisory board is helping to tell our staff how much they appreciate them. We have families who reach out to us, send us cards, tell us what a great job that we're doing. For the entire organization, for all of our employees, we have a room that people can go and take a break in that just gives them a break away from the stress that's out there. We still want them to rest because we know that this is exhausting for them.
It's got to be exhausting for you, too, and I can imagine as you look around the state, the Laramies, the Caspers, and all those places that are seeing multiple deaths and that kind of thing, it's got to scare the devil out of you.
To be honest, I've lived in a bit of being scared since March. Every day we come to work, we wonder what's going to happen that day, but preparation and, as I said before, everything we do goes back to avoid exposure and prevent transmission. And I, as a administrator and every other administrator in the state, know that this is really hard, but we're the gatekeeper, and we will stand in the gap for this.
Johnny Belden, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Once again, Johnny Belden oversees the Legacy Living and Rehabilitation Center in Campbell County. When we come back, we will look at how the strain of contact tracers across the state can also impact schools. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, the unusual response of one small town to a veteran's mental breakdown.
Walden's taking good care of you.
That is the truth. That's the truth.
We care about you.
Gabby's story, part 5 of the Ghost Towning series, how small towns are managing rural despair. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's COVID-19 surge is having an overwhelming effect on state and local contact tracers. Public health officials might not be able to reach everyone that may have been exposed, and that could have a major effect on K-12 schools all around the state, since it's up to the county and school district how they handle it. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Goshen County School District Superintendent Ryan Kramer about how the district has begun contact tracing all of its cases.
You know, we were one of the first positive confirmed cases as schools were starting. In the state, we went from 3 cases to 10 cases on November 2nd. We just had a significant start. So we now do have 20 active cases occurring in our district. As of last Friday, we had minimal to zero school spread, and that was, you know, really comforting in where we were at. Right now, as we kind of progress through this week, we can't be as confident. There are some questions with some recent positive cases.
And so if the spread in schools hasn't been a problem until recently, is it more that students have been getting it out in the community?
We found in our community, our individuals just not following the recommendations from their health service provider or the clinic when they've gone in or shown signs and symptoms, and they haven't been following the regulations that have been set forth through one to really stop the spread. We've had some situations where we found through our contact tracing and information that has been shared with from county health in regards to exposures and our collaboration with them, where we've had some students returning well before they should return and being involved in the quarantine situation. We found prior to this week that unequivocally, the mitigation strategies that we were utilizing, our face covering requirements, our social distancing, hand washing, all those things that we know to be effective, were having an excellent effect, a great effect on reducing the spread.
And so I've heard that maintaining staffing has been a big issue. Are there any other challenges that have arisen?
Just the overall mental health of our community members, our staff members, all of those things, because when we're in an environment where families are really concerned, and as parents are concerned with, you know, how things are going, how can I make a quarantine situation work, how can I afford this if I don't have proper child care for my children and I still have to work. We have fortunately not seen behavior pieces, but we have seen, you know, just challenging engagement pieces and understanding of concepts that we're introducing. And so it has a drastic effect on all of that. In addition to the stress level that many of our employees are facing, including, I just have to commend my nurses and their work as they've taken on, as the state has said, we're unable to keep up with this contact tracing. Our nurses have said, you know what, we're going to take this on along with our school administrators.
And so how has that transition been?
We had a system in place. We were kind of fortunate in having that first positive case where from that moment on, we took steps to say, okay, we have very, very clear seating charts. We have very clear practice plans that show exactly who was in contact with each person. And so when we would get the call, we would be able to put into action very quickly, these are all the close contacts that need to be contacted immediately. These are the close contacts that shouldn't be returning to school. We tried to get out ahead of that because it wasn't always possible for students to be contacted by state health officials and not come to school that next day. So we took it upon ourselves, you in contacting those students or staff members, saying you will most likely be getting a call from contact tracers at the state level, and we would recommend that you not come to school tomorrow because we're worried that you may expose others. And so we were well practiced in prior to even October in this. And so as soon as this hit, we then instituted through our nurses and our administrators kind of our own system in which, with cooperation with our county health officials, indicating guidance on quarantine for anybody that we felt was a close contact with any of our positive cases that occurred at school or we knew about and were notified at school.
Yeah, and so has the workload been difficult?
It's taken from my nurses an unbelievable amount of time, and they are already stressed because of the amount of normal situations they have around this and their normal work, this has just compounded that. And I have nurses working well into the evenings, you know, working with administrators, following. As soon as we have a positive case, it's almost like a trigger or an alarm goes off for them, and they become so proficient at that and done so well that I just can't commend them enough for the work they're doing and what that's allowed us to do at schools and be confident in still us attending in a regular environment here where we're face-to-face. Because if we weren't doing that, I think most of our ability to be confident that we're providing a safe environment would be not as high as it is right now.
Ryan Kramer is the superintendent of the Goshen County School District. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
I appreciate you taking the time to actually report on this. It's very important for us.
Changing gears, the pandemic has caused nationwide economic struggles, including here in Wyoming. But it's also created a new wave of entrepreneurs. In Laramie, Noah Greenspan reports that several new businesses have opened.
Lining the walls of Rihanna Hanshu's garage are large plastic containers filled with toys. Dolls, play pianos, a stack of colorful wooden semicircles that fit together like a rainbow. This is the Nest Toy Library. Hanshu says the idea is that kids move on from toys pretty quickly. Instead of continuously buying new ones from the store, you check out a few at a time and swap them later.
I think I had always sort of had it in the back of my head that this would be a fun idea to try and that it would be a really nice addition to Laramie, but I didn't really get serious about it until the pandemic hit.
Hanshu worked as a preschool teacher for years, but with two young children and a pandemic keeping everyone inside, she decided to shift gears. Opening during a pandemic means that Hanshu had to tailor her business model to the times. Figure out how to build an online catalog, for example. Find the right child-safe sanitizer. Recently elected state legislator Trey Sherwood directs the Laramie Main Street Alliance, an organization that assists and promotes local businesses. She says the city has actually seen a recent influx of new entrepreneurs.
We have like 9 new businesses that have opened downtown in the last 2 months or are about to open. So it's incredible to see people who have had an idea for a business say, okay, now's the time to jump.
Still, Sherwood says local entrepreneurs face a number of challenges, noting that in Laramie, small businesses have seen a 30% drop in revenue in recent months as customers shift to online retailers like Amazon. And there's another big challenge, too. Businesses can't act as meeting spaces anymore.
So there's a phrase we use in community building that talks about the importance of third spaces. And so pre-COVID, what this meant was your home is space one, your work is space two, and where you interact in public spaces like coffee shops, bars, restaurants, and parks, even a bowling alley, is your third space. Those third spaces, one, are struggling and aren't able to play the critical role in building people together.
Back at the toy library, Hanshu says she's been missing community too. At least for now, the toy library can only function as a pickup drop-off space.
My vision for the Nest is a lot more than just a toy library. I hope that we can have, you know, parenting classes and play groups. And I feel like our community is sort of lacking that aspect of just bringing families together, which is a powerful thing. And I think especially right now, something that we're really missing.
That gathering space is on hold for the foreseeable future. In the meantime, Sherwood's advice is to continue to support your local businesses in a safe way. If you live in Laramie, you can do that through Small Business Week, from November 27th through December 5th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Noah Greenspan.
Want to show her how we do a mermaid tail? Hmm? Okay. Okay. All right, put your legs flat.
Whoa!
There.
Your legs
go? Wow. Make me some. Look at this beautiful mermaid.
Wow.
I'm going to see that one.
Coming up, Hospitals are starting to get nervous as cases continue to climb. Plus, a look at what it's like when you get COVID-19. And thanks for your support of this station and hopefully this program. Don't forget that we can't bring you this show each and every week without your financial support. You can pledge online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature. Micah Meyer grew up the son of a pastor and secretly struggled with his sexuality. But on a record-setting road trip to all of America's national parks, he realized its success hinged on being open about who he was.
Every day, I was helping make somebody else's life better.
Out on the road, I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is the least populated state per capita, but is consistently in the top five states with the most new COVID-19 cases per day. Public health officials are asking people who have the virus or may have been exposed to follow social distance guidelines, no matter whether they feel sick or not. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains that's because any level of COVID is a serious one that may infect others.
Back in early March, when COVID-19 still seemed distant, Nicole Bondurant had just finished a workout in her basement.
When I came back upstairs, I just didn't feel very good. And it just kept getting worse and worse by the minute.
She checked her temperature and it was high. She didn't really understand what COVID was. The world was still just understanding the symptoms. But she figured she should be careful.
I went and quarantined in my room that night, and I didn't come out of quarantine until almost a month later.
For nearly a month, she experienced almost all the symptoms that we now know can be related to the virus.
I had shortness of breath, headache, extreme fatigue, sore throat, chest pain. It seems like every day there'd be a new symptom.
Meanwhile, Nicole's husband, Brent, and daughter, Josie, were at home helping take care of Nicole. And within a week, Brent had what he thought was an asthma attack.
But I haven't had asthma in 20 years, so it's been a long time since I had any problem with it. Inhalers kind of work, but not really. And basically, it's never gone away. I now have burning pain in my chest. It's not like my normal asthma wheezing.
Eventually, her daughter, Josie, admitted that she had lost her sense of smell. Within one household, there were three different spectrums of the virus: severe, mild, and almost no symptoms. And all three of them had the same capacity to spread the virus.
It's highly contagious.
That's Dr. Mark Dowell. He's an infectious disease physician and the Natrona County Health Officer.
A contagious case, an active case, may give birth to 3 or 4 additional cases. And they give birth to 3 or 4 additional cases. And that's why it's spreading so rampantly right now.
Dowell says about 40% of people have no symptoms. And then you take the other 60% of people that have symptoms. The spectrum is wide, from just a runny nose to being in the hospital on a ventilator.
It's important to point out that that is true with a lot of infectious diseases, not just this particular virus. There's a whole spectrum. You almost name the organism and you can see a spectrum of disease associated with it.
COVID-19 is a coronavirus. There are many different types of coronaviruses that affect human beings. The most common one is the cold. Dowell says the reason why someone has worse symptoms than another person depends on whether your immune system has seen one of the coronaviruses before and how strong your immune system is, which usually correlates with age.
What may play a role is how much virus did you inhale? Because if you just inhale a little bit, maybe your immune system can get on top of that a little quicker. and a little more easily than if you get a huge load of virus that gets into you all at once.
And Dowell continues to stress that no matter what range of symptoms a positive individual has, they need to follow the social distance guidelines, especially young people.
This idea that I'm invincible and it doesn't matter and I'm going to, it's my right to do this, this, and this, isn't fair to the rest of the people because we know it's highly contagious. And I've got a 29-year-old that's in the hospital right now that is deathly ill and was healthy.
Dowell says some more populated states are handling this much better than Wyoming.
Wyoming had 1,100 cases, new cases, with a population of, what's our population, 500,000 maybe. Massachusetts, population 6.7 million people, 1,000 new cases. 1,000 with a population of 500,000, 1,000 with a population of 6.7 million. If that gives you an idea of how serious this is.
For Nicole and Brent Bondurant, they are still feeling the effects of catching the virus. Both of them have lingering coughs and difficulty breathing still.
No one wants to feel like this, and no one would want to accidentally be the person that passed it on to someone and then someone they care about get, you know, sicker than we did or something. So it's just like a humane thing to do to wear a mask, socially distance. If you have symptoms, stay home.
Obviously not new advice, but it's advice that everyone needs to start following. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Hospital capacity is one metric that has stayed relatively stable throughout the pandemic. But in the past month, that's changed as hospitals run out of space and staffing is stretched thinner. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports the state is recruiting outside help, but healthcare workers are still feeling the pinch.
At Cody Regional Health, the pandemic is taking its toll on frontline healthcare workers. Chief Hospitalist Dr. Elise Lowe says caring for COVID-19 patients is not too complex, but it does require a lot of extra work.
It's tough to have a condition that we haven't really seen before, and so we're constantly reading up on new research and trying to follow the newest guidelines and make decisions on something that's pretty novel. Our workload is at least doubled.
Some days are quiet, but at a small hospital like West Park in Cody, that can change in an instant.
We can be feeling okay and suddenly get five new cases in an afternoon, and we've completely exceeded our capacity to treat those people. And then we're calling in people on emergency backup and making changes to our entire operating capacity.
All of this puts stress on the physicians, nurses, and other hospital staff responding to the pandemic. But the healthcare system itself is also stressed by the rapidly rising demand for hospital space and resources. Hospitalizations are spiking throughout the state. There were more days in the past week that set a new record for COVID hospitalizations than didn't. Eric Boley is the president of the Wyoming Hospital Association. He says the current trend is likely to continue.
Our larger facilities are definitely feeling the pinch right now. A lot of them have been close to, if not at complete capacity. Some of our larger facilities have actually opened up additional space so they can take even more patients.
In the past, many of the state's border communities could rely on hospitals in surrounding states for specialized or intensive care not available in town. But with the entire region experiencing an unprecedented surge in both cases and hospitalizations, options for out-of-state care are limited. Hospital and intensive care capacity are usually measured by available beds, but Boley says that's not the largest hurdle.
There may be available beds, but we're struggling to have enough staff to take care of the patients if we do admit them. That's our other big challenge right now.
It's a challenge that gets worse when healthcare workers get sick.
A lot of our hospitals are really facing some tough times because they got folks that are either quarantined or are sick with COVID, and so the numbers continue to rise as we continue to care for these patients.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will help by sending task forces to Campbell and Natrona counties, two raging hotspots. Meanwhile, the Wyoming National Guard will be deployed at the Cheyenne Regional Medical Center to perform non-medical duties, freeing up medical staff for more direct care. Governor Mark Gordon also dedicated $10 million in CARES Act funding for recruiting traveling healthcare workers. Boley says the Hospital Association has helped place 50 healthcare workers across the state, but it's been expensive.
In normal times, we know what the rates are, but we're having to pay a higher rate to be able to secure these folks, but that's the great part of the governor allowing us to use the CARES funding. It's given us a little bit of latitude to make sure that we can be competitive and bring in the staff that we need.
Wyoming healthcare workers are also aided by the fact that for several months, actions taken by the state and residents of Wyoming have flattened the curve, which gave state healthcare workers a chance to learn from other places. Ivinson Memorial Hospital Chief Nursing Officer Nicole Rooney says that's been helpful.
Now that we are a little less on the unknown side and we know what to expect as far as what symptoms you might see, what type of patients you might see, and then knowing the standard of care for these patients is definitely helping.
Despite the extra help and knowledge, Wyoming hospitals still face an overwhelming situation. Case counts continue to rise, which means hospitals will continue to be stretched. And of course, it's almost that time of year when flu and pneumonia cases grow. Rooney says this is going to take a toll on hospital workers' mental health.
And that's really been the struggle, is trying to keep that balance where we're asking them to come in extra, asking them to have a good work-life balance, and asking them to not feel run down at the end of that so they can come back the next week and do the same thing for their patients over and over and over again.
As many warned, all of this robs hospitals of the ability to perform elective surgeries or provide care they otherwise would. For example, Dr. Lowe says Cody Regional Health can only offer cardiac caths on specific days.
So if you have a heart attack on a day that we don't have that available, then we're looking to try to figure out where to transfer you, and that process can get very delayed if all the other hospitals are on divert. This is really a burden on an entire healthcare system that affects everybody's care.
On top of all of this, healthcare workers are facing vitriol from some vocal corners of the populace.
Early on in this thing, we had a lot of support in our community. You know, we're being called heroes, and it's kind of, you know, ironic because we weren't really seeing patients yet.
Now the work is harder, that support has dissipated, and the community is more divided.
We're getting accusations from our leadership and from our community that we've overplayed this, or that it's not real, or it's a hoax. To tell somebody who's watching people struggle to breathe that they're making it up and that it's a hoax, it's extremely hard on our mental health.
There's no sign of the pandemic improving in the coming weeks, or even decelerating. As winter sets in, healthcare workers and hospitals are bracing for the most brutal challenge they've ever faced. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
With lockdowns across the country, telehealth boomed a few months ago, and that unprecedented growth is expected to continue. But when it comes to mental health treatment over a screen, it's getting mixed reviews. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck has that story.
Logan Potter is a senior at Boise State University. Like many others, the pandemic is affecting her mental health.
I was struggling quite a bit, so I was like, I need to go to therapy.
With the lockdown, going to a provider's office was out, but her school's health services helped her find a therapist online. Once she started seeing them, though, she realized there was a problem: privacy. She lived with her boyfriend.
I was living in a studio apartment, and there was literally nowhere to go unless I was going to, I don't know, go to therapy while in my bathroom or something.
It also turned out that it wasn't that easy for her to find the right therapist. It wasn't that she didn't like her online match.
I think that she was really nice. I think that she like just wasn't a good fit for me, but then finding somebody who is a good fit for me is very challenging using telehealth.
She also needed a psychotherapist to prescribe medications and who would be available with advice if she had side effects. That didn't happen.
I ended up actually disliking the experience so much that I just stopped going.
At the other end of the spectrum, Jennifer Ekstrand is enjoying the new format. Yes, she says she's had some tech challenges, like grainy video or her rabbits chewing on computer cords, but overall,
it's had a surprising benefit in making me feel less self-conscious. I sometimes struggle to maintain eye contact while discussing my trauma in person, but since eye contact is so different with video, I don't feel like I'm breaking any social norms when I break eye contact.
These two different responses probably don't surprise Logan Lambrecht. He's a psychotherapist and says while telehealth is helpful, it's also been a mixed bag.
A lot of the clients that transition to telecounseling, I would say about a third to a half of them have asked to come back to in-person, just wearing masks with physical distancing in our office space.
As well as seeing patients, Lambrecht teaches students in the counseling department at Idaho State University Meridian. To learn, those students take on their own clients, and they've had to go through a crash course on teletherapy.
I think a lot of the training that's available hasn't been incredibly good. I think our students, even though they went through a certification process, we saw a lot of gaps in terms of really thinking about like the interpersonal applications of telecounseling.
So he's now working with his students to create their own best practices using resources of the school, like access to research. But here's the thing. When it comes to teletherapy, there's not much research on how to do it well. Dr. Chris Fohr believes we need to prioritize teletherapy as part of general training, and the research on the best way to do it will follow.
That research often takes place in those types of institutions and universities. So if they were starting to train, my assumption would be they would also start researching and developing those best practices that would have a broad evidence base.
Fohr is the founder and director of the Telebehavioral Health Center of Excellence, which serves Native tribes through Indian Health Services. That center has been around for 12 years, and he says they've learned some key bits of information about how to use teletherapy more generally, like being clearer with what you say or using your hands more.
And we have to train the provider to stare at the camera because then it looks like you're making that eye contact.
But aside from the lack of research on best practices, he says there's another big issue, internet access. The center used to provide telehealth at clinics, but with the pandemic, moved to a more in-home model.
So as someone that's been doing this for many years, I knew the digital divide existed, but I had no idea, unfortunately, of the breadth of the digital divide in Indian country.
They've had to use phone calls instead for some, which he says isn't ideal, but at least provides access. And he says it's clear that many patients are really liking access, any kind of access, that's close to home. So he expects telehealth to just keep growing and becoming more of the norm, even though some areas and some people may have a harder time with it than others. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
You know, it's worth mentioning that we are always looking for interesting stories on a wide range of topics, but two are currently on our horizon. We'd like to hear about an experience or an interesting tale about the pandemic, and we are continuing to add to our list of possible stories about race. You can propose those stories by emailing me through our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org or through the station Facebook page. We will wrap up the program in a moment. This is Open Spaces.
In this episode of the Kids Ask Why podcast, Sam and Molly believe the two things that make their home state amazing are
wide open spaces,
wildlife.
So they test their hypothesis out.
The special things about Wyoming are, which are big open spaces, and also living with wildlife.
What would happen if the open lands of Wyoming shrunk or even disappeared?
Wyoming would be the loser, the people of Wyoming.
Find Kids Ask Why under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. According to a Pew Research Center study, scientist is one of the most trusted professions in the U.S., second only to the military. Trust levels are lower for K-12 principals, religious leaders, the media, and elected officials. So why do we hear so many people question scientific findings? Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone explains.
Science communication expert Katie Cooper is an assistant professor in the Communication and Journalism Department at the University of Wyoming. Cooper says that our personal biases play a huge role in how we interpret science.
We all kind of have a tendency to conform new information to our already held beliefs. So we process information based on what we already think. And typically, we tend to fit that information to where it matches what we already think because that takes a lot less brain power, takes a lot less effort, doesn't make us feel bad for being wrong.
Cooper was an author on a study that tested trust in science for both conservatives and liberals.
When people were exposed to information that's considered value incongruent, so something that disagrees with their political ideology, people report decreased trust in the institution of science. And so this is pretty alarming. It happens for both liberals and conservatives. It just depends on the issue.
Cooper says the reason we may hear more about conservatives distrusting science is because the topics they disagree with are more prevalent in the media. UW atmospheric scientist Shane Murphy has a different take on the distrust issue.
I often wonder if, you know, the resistance is because there's no easy way out. So it's hard to accept a fact that means you're going to have to significantly change your life. And I guess that's my feeling more than anything. It's not really anything about the quality of the science. It's just that the science is presenting an uncomfortable result.
Murphy says this often applies to climate change.
Especially in the climate field or sometimes in the air quality field, there's science that people just don't want to accept, even though it's very robust.
Katie Cooper, the science communication expert we talked to earlier, says the same concepts apply to the pandemic.
I think that a lot of the rejection of expert recommendations about things like mask wearing and social distancing really comes down to fear and a resistance to uncertainty. To say I accept that mask wearing is necessary, it follows that I also accept that COVID-19 is a legitimate threat to the safety of myself and others, and that can be scary to acknowledge.
Another UW science communicator, Kristen Landreville, says that trust in general is hard to achieve and very easy to break. She uses the current controversy about face masks as an example.
I think what you had happen is a lack of transparency, and that created a lack of trust in future communication by the CDC. You know, people say, well, why should I believe them now when they kind of lied to us before? And, you know, those are very good questions. But then you look at the, you know, dozens and dozens of scientific studies that have now come out.
UW professor Alex Berkeley is often surprised when people ignore expert opinions.
I'm a scientist. I've been a scientist for quite a while. But in areas that are not my specialty, I have to rely on the experts myself. Just like we rely on experts to perform medical procedures or to fly airplanes.
Berkeley says that he thinks distrust in science has been deliberately pushed by commercial and political interests, and it's nothing new.
There was active sowing of mistrust of science with respect to the dangers of smoking, for example.
Science communicator Landreville says that trust in science is not equal across the board.
We see that trust in science among marginalized communities, minority groups, those, you know, more marginalized groups of people historically tend to be more skeptical and less trusting of science compared to whites.
Landreville says that maybe because there have been a number of instances where minorities and people of color were used in experiments without their consent. She says acknowledging mistakes and being transparent may lead to more trust in science. But science communication expert Katie Cooper says trust in science can be a very individual process.
Several studies have actually shown that the more informed or educated a person is, the better the tools they have to counter-argue new information. So say a well-educated individual is politically opposed to climate change, they're better at convincing themselves that the science information that they receive is wrong because they're better at producing counter-arguments against that scientific data.
In an age where information of any kind is readily available to back up an argument, overcoming personal biases can be incredibly difficult. Landreville says the best thing you can do is check your facts, check your friends' facts, and have real discussions using real evidence. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ashley Piconi.
Democrats once again lost ground in much of the rural West this election, including in Montana, where Senator John Tester will soon be the only Democrat holding a statewide office. Tester recently wrote a book about how progressives can win back rural America. He spoke with the Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie.
I'm not sure we have much of a message at all for rural America, and I know I'm being critical of the folks that are in leadership in Washington, D.C., but the truth is that Democrats, at the national level in particular, need to do as I said in my book, and that is go out to rural America and listen to what they're talking about. And what they're talking about is they're talking about jobs, and they're talking about consolidation in agriculture, and they're talking about the need for good infrastructure. The trade policies of this administration should have flowed a lot of voters into the Democratic column. We never took advantage of that as Democrats, and we never ran on the things that we were going to do as far as creating jobs through good trade policies.
In campaign ads this year, the Democratic Party was labeled as being out of touch. Party of socialism, identity politics, Bernie Sanders. To what degree do you believe that the progressive wing of the party is hurting or helping the Democrats' chances in mainly white communities in the rural West?
So, look, I think the Democratic Party is a big tent. And the fact is that there's room for all sorts of different policies that move forward. And I'm not going to be critical of any policies that Bernie puts forth or that Joe Manchin put forth. And those are about the two sides of the party. The fact is that I think what policies we need to put forth when it comes to rural America are policies that rural Americans can connect with. Now, make no mistake about it, Nate. This election, they expanded on the things like socialism and packing the court and all that stuff. Fact of the matter is, I don't hear much of that talk out of Democrats' mouths at all. The vast majority of them, I never heard about packing the courts. I never heard about socialism. I never heard nobody that I talked to in D.C. that talked about defunding the police. Yet, those were issues that were made to be big issues this election cycle. And I think in order to counteract that, we've got to have a better message. And it all starts by listening. And I don't think Democrats do a good enough job of listening and developing a message that rural folks can hear and go, yeah, those guys are the right ones for the job. And I think that's where the mistake has been made.
And we've also heard criticism recently that Democrats aren't doing enough sustained grassroots organizing in rural non-Indigenous communities. I mean, how can the party be visible in those places when it doesn't hold state legislative seats, county commissions, or even school boards?
Well, look, I think that how you organize people is talking to them about issues that they view as being very, very important to their communities. And then if this pandemic has taught us anything, it's the fact that there are too many people on the wrong side of the digital divide, and we need better broadband in this state. And so there are plenty of issues for people to talk about. And I think that's the best way to organize. That's the best way to get people excited about a political party. And that's what we need to do more of as Democrats.
And, you know, in your book, you write that, quote, rural America is in desperate need of visionaries who can see and are willing to look around the corners for our kids and grandkids. I mean, looking at the Democratic Party today, who are those leaders that can reach rural America?
Well, I mean, I would like to think that I'm one of them, but there are other people, I think, that are out there that can do it, too. The Tim Kaines of the world, the Michael Bennett's of the world, the Martin Heinrichs of the world, the Amy Klobuchars of the world, and there's others, too. There's plenty of people out there who can reach out and talk to rural America in ways where rural America can relate with.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This show and our stories will be archived on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just find Open Spaces under the News pull-down tab. You can also take Open Spaces with you and listen anytime via our Open Spaces podcast, which is available at all the usual places. Anna Rader is our web editor. Have a safe Thanksgiving. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.